Brett Kavanaugh in 2018 cemented a 5-4 conservative majority on the court in terms of judicial philosophy. That, in turn, promised to have an impact on a host of hot-button issues that included abortion, voting rights, and immigration law, among others. Changing who's in charge of the House. This is how split America was when it came to the 2018 midterm elections, the ones that fall between presidential elections. 6 of 9 brothers and sisters of an Arizona Republican congressman named Paul Gosar publicly endorsed his Democratic opponent. The congressman's siblings said they were alarmed at what they said were his extremist views on immigration, health care, and white supremacists. Gosar easily won re-election anyway. Not all GOP incumbents were as lucky, even if all their relatives liked them. Democrats took control of the House of Representatives for the first time since 2010. Republicans, however, held on to control of the Senate. A number of firsts among the results reflected America's changing face. For the first time, at least 100 women were elected to the 435-member House of Representatives. The first Muslim and Native American women were elected. The first openly gay man was elected governor of a state. Of the new House members, 35 were under the age of 40, when the average age of the current House members was 57. More than $5 billion was spent on the campaigns, another first. There was nothing unusual about the reigning party losing seats in a midterm election. In fact, in only 2 midterm elections since 1910, had the party in power actually increased its majority. But seldom have the differences between partisans of the 2 major parties been as deep. An August 2018 Pew Research Center survey found that 78% of Americans were convinced that Democrats and Republicans couldn't even agree on what was fact, let alone on how to handle the country's problems. There was also nothing unusual about the midterms being seen as a referendum on the president's policies and performance, although the unorthodoxy of the Trump administration certainly heightened the aspect in 2018. The president stumped at 30 campaign rallies in 20 states after Labor Day in early September, with mixed results. He appeared 3 times in Missouri to successfully help a Republican Senate candidate unseat a Democratic incumbent, for example, while 3 visits to Montana failed to accomplish the same thing. Trump nonetheless declared the election results very close to a complete victory at a press conference the day after the election and said he was willing to work with the House Democratic majority. But he also threatened to adopt a warlike posture if they began investigations into his business dealings, tax returns, or actions as president. If there was a positive effect of the deep partisan rift, it was that it galvanized voter participation. The 2018 turnout was estimated at 47% of eligible voters, far higher than 2014's 36.4% or 2010's 41%. In fact, it was the highest turnout since 1966 for a midterm election. But even as they voted, exit polls showed most voters weren't happy about things. 56% said they didn't like Trump. 55% said they didn't like Democratic House Leader Nancy Pelosi. And 56% said the country was going in the wrong direction. With friends like these, just like Americans, most of the rest of the world viewed the new president with applause, alarm, and or puzzlement. At home, he ignored traditional political decorum. Abroad, he demonstrated a healthy disdain for diplomacy. He referred to the Canadian Prime Minister as very dishonest and weak. Mexico was the #1 most dangerous country in the world. Germany was totally controlled by Russia. He also reportedly complained about all these people from shithole countries immigrating to America instead of more people from places like Norway. Trump later denied using those exact words, but not expressing that opinion. Putting America first. At the root of Trump's foreign policy was his fervent embrace of nationalism, which is generally defined as embracing the culture, traditions, needs, and wishes of one country above all others. But the term also has more troubling political overtones, since it was often used by racist and xenophobic groups to describe themselves. From this moment on, it's going to be America first, Trump said in his inaugural address. Every decision on trade, on taxes, on immigration, on foreign affairs will be made to benefit American workers and American families. We must protect our borders from the ravages of other countries making our products, stealing our companies, and destroying our jobs. He rattled America's 28 partners in the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, by complaining they weren't paying their fair share of the Mutual Defense Alliance's costs. He withdrew the country from the Paris Agreement, an international framework designed to reduce environmental pollution and combat climate change, in part because he felt the agreement impinged on U.S. sovereignty. And he pulled America out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a 12-country agreement to lower tariffs between member nations and boost trade. Trading insults on trade. A recurring Trump campaign theme was what he said was a need to decrease the U.S. trade deficit by balancing things America bought from the rest of the world with the stuff the rest of the world bought from America. Other countries, he said, protected their domestic industries with unfair tariffs on U.S. goods, while U.S. tariffs remained low. We are being taken advantage of, the president declared, and I don't like it. So in January 2018, Trump cited national security concerns in imposing a 30% tariff on solar panels and a 20% duty on washing machines, most of them from China. China soon retaliated with a tariff on U.S. sorghum. Trump followed up with more tariffs on Chinese goods and tariffs on steel and aluminum imports from a host of other nations as well. Canada, the European Union, and other countries countered with higher tariffs on U.S. products. By the end of 2018, U.S. tariffs were being imposed on products from frog legs to socket wrenches, while other countries were levying higher tariffs on U.S. peanut butter, motorcycles, and just about everything else. The reaction domestically was, as with almost everything else Trumpian, decidedly mixed. Trade associations, business leaders, and industries adversely affected complained the trade wars would drive up prices and drive some companies out of business. Labor unions and companies poised to take advantage of less competition from overseas products applauded. And while many economists warned the trade wars would damage the U.S. economy in the long run, Trump argued the result would be more U.S. manufacturing jobs. Closer to home, America reached a new trade deal in October 2018 with its neighbors, Canada and Mexico. Dubbed the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Agreement, USMCA, the deal replaced the 24-year-old North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA. Trump and others, including some Democratic political leaders, had long complained that NAFTA had siphoned U.S. jobs to Mexico and unfairly favored some Canadian industries. While the changes made by the new deal were relatively minor, all three countries called it a win-win-win, in large part because it took 13 months to hammer out and was in danger of falling apart completely up until the last minute. Sorting out friend from foe. In addition to picking fights over trade, the new president wasn't shy about throwing rhetorical punches on other issues at other countries, both traditional allies and opponents. He critiqued the British government's handling of that country's exit from the European Union, suggested the German prime minister was ruining Germany, called North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un Little Rocket Man, and referred to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad as Animal Assad for the dictator's use of chemical weapons in that country's civil war. More interesting, or baffling, was Trump's approach to Russia, a longtime U.S. adversary. He extended Obama administration economic sanctions against Russia and Russian individuals and added some of his own. He ordered U.S. missiles fired at Russia-supported military sites in war-torn Syria. And he expelled 60 Russian diplomats after a former Russian spy and his daughter were poisoned by suspected Russian agents in England. But he was openly skeptical about charges Russia interfered in America's 2016 elections. See Chapter 25 for more details. And he said several times he had no reason to doubt the sincerity of Russian President Vladimir Putin when Putin denied Russian interference. "Is he my enemy? He is not my enemy," Trump said of Putin in July 2018 before meeting with him at a summit conference in Helsinki, Finland. "Hopefully someday he will be a friend. He has said some nice things about me." Another subject of Jekyll and Hyde diplomacy was North Korea. Angered by that country's nuclear weapons testing and bellicose threats by North Korean officials, Trump said in August 2017 that the Asian country would be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen if it continued threatening the United States. A few months later, he suggested war with North Korea might be inevitable. But in the spring of 2018, Kim Jong-un suddenly reversed course and said North Korea was willing to end its nuclear weapons program. In June 2018, Trump and Kim met in Singapore and signed a statement pledging to better relations between the two countries. The president subsequently took credit for pulling the nation back from the brink of nuclear war. "I was really being tough, and so was he," Trump joked at a political campaign rally in September. "And we were going back and forth, and then we fell in love, okay? No, really. He wrote me beautiful letters. And they're great letters. We fell in love." By early November 2018, however, the two nations were back to rhetorically dueling over whether America's economic sanctions against North Korea would have to be lifted before North Korea gave up its weapons program. More consistent was the approach to Iran. Trump had warned before the election he might withdraw America from a 2015 multi-nation deal in which Iran promised to stop its nuclear weapons development if other countries lifted financial sanctions against it that had crippled Iran's economy. In May 2018, Trump announced U.S. withdrawal from the deal. In November, the day before the U.S. midterm elections, the sanctions were reimposed. They live in Springfield, the one with the ever-burning mountain of tires, the monorail to nowhere, and the nuclear power plant continually on the verge of a meltdown. The patriarch was a lazy, stupid, alcoholic yet down-deep good-hearted oaf. The matriarch, a nagging optimist constantly teetering on the verge of hysteria, with a bride of Frankenstein tower of blue hair. The son was a sociopathic underachiever, whose conscience was seemingly just big enough to keep him from serial killings. The eldest daughter was a neurotic saxophone-playing genius, and the youngest was a baby who was at least 30 years old and still didn't talk. Together, they formed one of America's most beloved families. They were, as virtually anyone who ever watched television between 1989 and November 2018 can tell you, The Simpsons. Through more than 30 seasons and more than 640 episodes, Homer, Marge, Bart, Lisa, and Maggie starred in an animated series that poked fun at and satirically prodded just about every aspect of American culture and the human condition. Created by Portland, Oregon cartoonist and writer Matt Groening, the show won dozens of awards, was the longest-running primetime TV program in history, earned the fictional family a star on Hollywood's Walk of Fame, and spun off a 2007 film that grossed more than $500 million. Time magazine declared it the best television show of the 20th century. Dazzlingly intelligent and unapologetically vulgar, The Simpsons have surpassed the humor, topicality, and yes, humanity of past TV greats. Oh, and dough? That was Homer's favorite expression, which he uttered, shouted, groaned, and exclaimed hundreds of times in almost every conceivable situation. It became so familiar that in 2001 it entered the Oxford English Dictionary, where it was defined as expressing frustration at the realization that things have turned out badly. But the dictionary folks, for some reason, left out the apostrophe. Probably a mistake.
Don't.
Guns, drugs, and hashtag Me Too. As the 21st century sped through its second decade, America found itself wrestling with two all-too-familiar problems, gun violence and drug abuse, and an old problem that heretofore had not been much in the public eye, sexual harassment, shooting each other at alarming rates. While it ran counter to the perceptions of many Americans, violent crime actually fell sharply through the end of the 20th century and the start of the 21st. Statistics compiled by the FBI found there were 747 violent crimes per 100,000 residents in 1993, compared to 386 in 2016. Sadly, however, the decline did not apply to mass public shootings. The overall number of mass public shootings, defined as incidents where four or more people were killed in a public venue, stayed relatively stable, between 4 and 5 per year. But the enormity of the crimes in terms of sheer size grew at a horrific pace. Starting in 1948, it took 60 years for America to suffer 14 mass public shootings with 9 or more victims. Starting in 2009 and running through late 2018, it took just 10 years to suffer 15 more. A 2016 study found that while the United States had about 4.5% of the world's population, it owned an estimated 42% of the guns and played host to 31% of the planet's public mass shootings. The varying scenes of the crimes fostered an impression that nowhere was safe. 58 killed at an outdoor music concert in Las Vegas. 49 killed at an Orlando, Florida nightclub. 26 at a church in Sutherland Springs, Texas, 17 at a high school in Parkland, Florida, and 12 at a Thousand Oaks, California bar and dance hall. We simply cannot accept this violence as a normal part of American life, Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf said after an anti-Semitic gunman killed 11 people at a Pittsburgh synagogue in late October 2018. These senseless acts of violence are not who we are as Pennsylvanians, and are not who we are as Americans. There was certainly no paucity of firearms. Although there was no firm count, it was generally accepted that the number of U.S. guns was about 265 million in 2018, or about 80 weapons for every 100 Americans. That was nearly double the next highest country, Yemen. Americans were also far more likely to die from a gunshot than in other countries, 98 times more likely than a Japanese, 55 times more likely than a Briton, and 38.5 times more likely than an Indonesian. In some of the shootings, the gunmen adapted their weapons to be more efficient killers. Using a bump stock, a device added to a semi-automatic rifle that allows the shooter to continuously pull the trigger as the gun recoils, allowed a 64-year-old man to fire more than 1,100 rounds in 10 minutes from his Las Vegas hotel room in October 2017, spraying death on a crowd assembled below for a concert. A Pew Research Center poll in October 2018 found that more than 75% of both Democratic and Republican voters supported preventing people with mental illness from buying guns. barring gun sales to those on watch lists of federal law enforcement agencies, and requiring background checks when guns changed hands at gun shows or through private sales. But while some states passed their own gun control laws and regulations, Congress and the Trump administration remained immobilized. Despite an almost immediate call for a ban on bump stocks, for example, the devices were still legal in most states a year after the Las Vegas massacre. Black lives matter, and so do cops. As divisive an issue as gun control was, what seemed like a continual stream of incidents occurred in which police officers shot and killed young African-American males, who sometimes turned out to be unarmed and whose deaths were often videotaped by police cameras or those of witnesses. The cases included a 22-year-old Sacramento man shot in his grandmother's backyard when police mistook his cell phone for a gun, a 12-year-old Cleveland boy who was playing with a BB gun, and a 17-year-old Chicago youth who was running away from officers when he was shot multiple times. While cities sometimes paid large cash settlements to the victims' families and officers were fired, criminal convictions of police were rare. Of 15 high-profile cases between 2014 and 2016, only three resulted in guilty verdicts. Part of the reason was a U.S. Supreme Court ruling that police were justified in using deadly force if they had reasonable apprehension their lives or the lives of others were threatened. Police and their defenders also pointed out that more than 80 officers were shot and killed in 2017 and 2018 alone. But the number of incidents caught on video triggered the formation of a loosely structured movement called Black Lives Matter in 2013. Using social media and more traditional marches and demonstrations, the movement heightened public attention to the issue. It also triggered backlash that included the formation of Blue Lives Matter, a group that called for anyone convicted of killing a police officer to be sentenced under hate crime statutes that generally called for enhanced punishments. Dying from drugs. In December 2017, the Centers for Disease Control, CDC, published a series of reports with a sobering conclusion. The overall life expectancy of Americans had dropped, in large part because so many people were dying from drug overdoses. According to the CDC, the annual number of U.S. overdose deaths had risen from about 22,000 in 2002 to more than 70,000 in 2017, a 318% increase in 15 years. The drugs of choice were opioids, a group that included heroin, a synthetic drug called fentanyl, and prescription pain reducers such as oxycodone, hydrocodone, and morphine. Deaths from opioids rose from about 10,000 in 2002 to 49,000 in 2017, a nearly 500% jump. Part of the reason was a dramatic increase in prescriptions written by doctors for painkillers starting in the 1990s. The number of prescriptions tripled between 1991 and 2009. Patient advocacy groups were lobbying for pain to be treated as a disease in itself and not just a symptom. And pharmaceutical companies pushed newly developed pain reducers such as OxyContin as safe and effective. At the same time, other drugs such as fentanyl, a pain-reducing drug that can be 50 times stronger than heroin and was primarily used for cancer patients, became a popular street drug because of its potency. It was also cheaper to produce than heroin or cocaine and was sometimes mixed into those drugs to bulk up their volume. There was some evidence the crisis was leveling off by the end of 2018, possibly from the impacts of public awareness programs, the increased availability of an anti-overdose drug called naloxone, and laws passed in some states that made it tougher for doctors to write prescriptions for pain-reducing drugs. In 2017, President Trump declared the problem a national public health emergency, and about $1 billion in federal funds were made available for states to finance anti-drug programs. but the collective reaction to the issue made many doctors leery about treating pain with drugs at all, which made life more difficult for thousands of people suffering from chronic pain. Meanwhile, other studies found that Americans were dying sooner than people in other developed countries, such as Japan, Canada, and Australia, in part because of increased consumption of alcohol. The CDC estimated America suffered about 88,000 alcohol-related deaths each year, shortening those lives by about 30 years. Oh, and if that's not cheery enough, the CDC also reported in 2018 that suicide rates rose nearly 30% between 1999 and 2015. More than half were committed by using a gun. Confronting sexual harassment. In 1997, Tarana Burke, a New York City community activist, was talking to a 13-year-old girl who had been sexually abused and realized she couldn't think of anything to comfort the girl, not even saying, "Me too." 10 years later, Burke did respond by creating a nonprofit organization to help victims of sexual harassment and assault. She called it Me Too. And 10 years after that, an actress, Alyssa Milano, used the web-based social medium, Twitter, to suggest all women who had been assaulted or harassed write Me Too, a hashtag, the pound symbol that makes it easier to follow a topic or group on social media, was added, and the movement gained national attention. Milano's tweet was in reaction to a scandal centered on sexual abuse and harassment allegations by scores of women against Harvey Weinstein, a prominent Hollywood film producer. It also followed the pre-2016 election release of a 2005 audio tape in which Donald Trump bragged about sexually harassing women with impunity. Because, when you're a star, they let you do that. You can do anything. Trump was elected president. Weinstein was arrested in May 2018 on rape and other charges. But Weinstein was only the start. By the end of 2018, the New York Times reported at least 200 men in prominent positions had lost their jobs over sexual harassment allegations. They included U.S. Senator Al Franken of Minnesota, television talk show host Bill O'Reilly, actor Kevin Spacey, and Missouri Governor Eric Greitens. The movement was hailed as empowering women and exposing a societal cancer that had been ignored for decades. It was also criticized for encouraging false or reckless charges that ruined men's careers, and deeming accused men guilty unless they could prove they hadn't done something they hadn't done. But the movement had an indisputable impact. Time magazine named hashtag MeToo its Person of the Year in 2017, and labeled the movement one of the highest velocity shifts in our culture since the 1960s. Weathering the weather. Mark Twain was said to have once said, "Everybody talks about the weather, but nobody does anything about it." But through the first two decades of the 21st century, yet another issue dividing Americans was whether human beings actually were doing something about the weather, or at least the world's climate, and not for the good. Most scientists believed they were. More than 200 worldwide scientific organizations and an estimated 97% of climate scientists were convinced that human actions, most particularly the burning of fossil fuels such as coal, oil, and natural gas, were causing global temperatures to rise and affecting climate and weather patterns. A June 2017 report by a group of federal agencies found it was extremely likely human actions had caused the world's climate to change. Whatever the cause of bad weather, it seemed to be getting more frequent. In the 30 years from 1980 to 2010, according to the National Centers for Environmental Information, NCEI, America suffered 136 weather or climate disasters that, adjusting for inflation, each resulted in more than $1 billion in economic losses. in the less than 8 years from 2011 through September 2018, there were 102 such incidents. In fact, three of the four costliest years on record were 2016, 2017, and 2018. The other was 2011. There were wildfires. California suffered the largest fire in its history in the summer of 2018, when a single blaze consumed 454 square miles and forced tens of thousands to flee their homes. At the same time, 16 other fires were burning in the state. In November 2018, the state was hit with its deadliest wildfire ever, killing at least 56 people and destroying the entire town of Paradise. And there were hurricanes. In August 2017, Hurricane Harvey hit the southeast, particularly Texas. The catastrophic storm flooded Houston, the nation's fourth-largest city, killing 106 people, and did a record $125 billion in damage. A month later, Hurricane Maria hit the U.S. territory of Puerto Rico, killing more than 3,000 people and inflicting $91 billion in damage. The issue wasn't confined only to individual weather disasters. Because of melting ice caps and higher water temperatures, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, projected in 2018 that ocean levels were rising at record rates. That, NOAA said, could increase the chance of flooding in American coastal communities by as much as 900% in coming years. Americans, or at least 61% of them, according to an ABC Stanford University poll in July 2018, thought the federal government should be doing a great deal about the issue, and 62% disapproved of President Trump's decision to withdraw the United States from the 2015 Paris Agreement, in which nearly every other country in the world agreed to try to combat climate change by cutting the use of fossil fuels. But only half of those polled saw climate change as becoming a more serious problem if nothing was done. And, unsurprisingly, there was a deep partisan divide. While 78% of Democrats saw it as a serious problem, just 25% of Republicans thought so. Among that latter number was President Trump. In an October 2018 television interview, Trump backed off his often stated assertion that climate change was a hoax perpetrated by either the Chinese or scientists with a political agenda. Instead, the president said, that even if climate change was real, it might just reverse direction by itself, and that it wasn't worth risking jobs and damage to the national economy to address it. Trump's comments followed the fatalistic conclusion of an August 2018 report by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, NHTSA, which was looking into the validity of the Trump administration's proposal to roll back federal requirements that motor vehicles be more fuel efficient. The NHTSA said that while average global temperatures would likely rise a devastating 7 degrees by the end of the century, it was too late to do anything about it, so there was no reason to require vehicles to use less gasoline. Goats and Cubs. When ushers at Chicago's Wrigley Field barred Billy Cyanis from bringing his pet goat Murphy into Game 4 of the 1945 World Series between the Chicago Cubs and Detroit Tigers, he demanded to know why. After all, he had a ticket for the goat. "Because," Cubs owner Philip K. Wrigley told him, "the goat stinks." Cyanis was so incensed, he told Wrigley the Cubs would not only lose the 45 series, they would never win a World Series again. Or at least, that's the legend. Whatever its veracity, the fact was that the Cubs not only lost the series in 1945, they seemed fated to never even reach baseball's ultimate contest again, let alone win it. A National League franchise since the league's founding in 1876, the Cubs won series titles in 1907, 1908, and that was it. They lost their next seven attempts including 1945, and thereafter became a national symbol of futility. For example, in 2003, the year of the goat on the Chinese calendar, the team came within 5 outs of getting to the series when a Cubs fan reached out for a foul ball and kept a Cubs player from making the catch. The Cubs went on to lose the game. Attempts were made over the years to lift the curse of Billy's goat. Cyanis forgave the team before he died in 1970. His nephew returned with a goat, and with the intercession of Ernie Banks, a legendary Cubs superstar, was allowed entrance. The Cubs' dugout was sprinkled with holy water. Goats were donated to impoverished families in developing countries. 5 fans ate a 40-pound goat at a local Mexican restaurant. Nothing worked. Finally, in 2016, the team was forced to rely on good players. 7 All-Stars and the league's most valuable player, and a baseball brilliant manager. The Cubs beat the Cleveland Indians in one of the most thrilling World Series of all time. The curse was over. This did not make for good news in Cleveland. The Indians, having not won a World Series since 1948, donned the mantle of the franchise with the longest baseball world championship drought. And they couldn't blame it on a goat. Chapter 25. This New America. In this chapter, making life more technical through technology, getting older, changing America's faces, redefining families. Over the years, America's multicultural, multi-ethnic, multiracial populace has been described by playwrights, demographers, and other assorted deep thinkers as a melting pot, a mixed salad, a fondue, and even tomato soup. The common ingredient in all those descriptions is that the country has proved itself pretty adaptable, even when change hasn't come easy. As the new century unfolded, continually evolving technology revolutionized the ways people got their information, talked to one another, and entertained themselves. At the same time, immigration, changing cultural mores, and just plain living longer were altering how they lived and with whom. The Techno-Revolution. In 1965, a California physicist named Gordon Moore made a prediction. Moore was helping to develop semiconductor microchips made of silicon, and 3 years later co-founded Intel, which became the world's largest microchip maker. He observed that the number of transistors that could be crammed onto a single chip had been doubling every 2 years. He thought they would probably continue to do so for some years into the future. He was right, and then some. In 1975, 5,000 transistors per chip was a pretty good ratio. By 2018, it was 19.2 billion. The microchip had become the foundation for nearly every aspect of American life, from buying stocks to falling in love. But first, the news. Getting the news, real and fake, from new news sources. Throughout most of U.S. history, Americans got most of their news from 3 kinds of media. First, newspapers, then radio, and then TV. In the first years of the 21st century, however, that began to change. Newspapers nosedive. In 2000, 56% of Americans surveyed said they had watched TV news the day before, 47% had read newspapers, and 43% had listened to radio news. In 2017, the answers were 50% TV, 18% newspapers, 25% radio, and 43% online, a news source not even tabulated in the 2000 survey. Hard as tit by the advent of online news was the print media. In 2018, only one major weekly news magazine, Time, was still publishing a print product. From 2000 to 2017, daily newspaper circulation dropped 45%. More ominous for newspapers, print advertising revenue dropped 75% between 2003 and 2017. Many papers tried to recover by launching their own websites as adjuncts to their print products. By 2018, far more people read the New York Times online each day than read it in print. The rise of the web as a news medium also saw rise of a host of new news competitors. Web-based news aggregators, such as the Huffington Post, launched in 2005, or specialized news-gathering organizations, such as Politico, launched in 2007, gave news seekers a cornucopia of choices. The bad news was that many websites focused as much on spreading rumors, gossip, and propaganda as on journalism. Readers had more choices, but not all of them were good ones. TV troubles. While the web's immediate impact wasn't as great on TV news as it was on newspapers, the traditional big three of TV, NBC, CBS, and ABC, found things getting a lot more crowded on America's airwaves. In 1996, Congress approved the first sweeping reform of U.S. telecommunications laws since 1934. One of the law's effects was to pave the way for hundreds of new TV channels and networks, delivered via satellite and through cable systems. By 2013, Americans seeking a dose of TV news could pick from the traditional three broadcast networks, or CNN, Fox News, MSNBC, CNBC, PBS, Univision, and others. By 2018, cable and satellite-based news networks were drawing more viewers than their broadcast counterparts. But as with web-based news sources, while the variety was a big plus for consumers, the quality of journalism sometimes wasn't. We've discovered many smart new voices out there, veteran TV journalist Bob Schieffer observed in late 2013. And excuse me for being blunt, a lot of people who have absolutely no idea what they're talking about. Faking it. As far as President Trump was concerned, the news was not only full of mistakes, but full of falsehoods, what Trump called, often in capital letters, fake news. Although he was far from the first president to hold the news media in low regard, he was among the loudest ever when it came to complaining publicly about it. Trump continually branded negative reports about his administration or himself personally as deliberate lies meant to undermine his presidency. "The fake news is not my enemy. It is the enemy of the American people," he said in 2017. In the wake of the November 2018 elections, Trump went so far as to ban one TV reporter from the White House after a shouting match with him during a press conference. Trump's opponents, including many in the news media, responded that in many cases, the president was merely blaming the messenger for bad news, or trying to deflect pervasive and often persuasive criticism that he played fast and loose with the facts himself. Several news organizations routinely ran analyses of Trump's remarks and speeches that pointed out what they said were his exaggerations, half-truths, and outright lies. But a lot of people agreed with Trump. A June 2018 Gallup poll reported 62% of Americans thought the news they saw or heard was biased, and 44% believed it to be inaccurate. The traditional news media's credibility gap, combined with the vast array of online news outlets and the rise of web-based social media, radically changed how Americans got their news. It led to more tribalism. People tended to gather information from sources that reinforced the views they already held, and that in turn deepened political and cultural divisions. Calling all cells. On a brisk, clear day in April 1973. 44-year-old engineer Martin Cooper was crossing 6th Avenue in New York City when he decided to call an engineer friend at a rival company and razz him about a device Cooper's company had just invented. So Cooper took out his newly invented cell phone. It measured 10 inches long, weighed 2.5 pounds, and if it had been for sale, would have cost at least $3,500, $20,750 in 2018 dollars. Remember, improvements were made. In fact, cell phones became pretty popular. In 2002, an estimated 62% of American adults had a cell phone. By 2018, 95% did. As cell phone use proliferated, the use of landline phones waned. A government study found that while 95% of American households had traditional phones in 2003, just 48.5% had them in 2017. More than two-thirds of cell phones were smartphones, which were basically mini-computers. You could use them to navigate, take photos, check sports scores, read restaurant reviews, send text messages, and listen to music. Americans did all these things and more. By 2018, research showed the average adult American spent more than 4 hours a day on the phone, about 3 hours of it using various features and programs referred to as apps, shorthand for applications. They also came in handy in emergencies. An estimated 70% of the 240 million calls to the 911 emergency number in the country in 2017 were from cell phones. Americans not only were almost constantly in touch with one another and most of the rest of the world, but also probably carried access to more information in their pockets than their grandparents had access to in their entire lifetimes. Nearly every aspect of daily life was made easier. Of course, this development wasn't all good. In 2018, it was estimated that cell phone use was a key factor in 25% of U.S. traffic accidents, resulting in more than 420,000 injuries. By 2018, 47 states had laws prohibiting texting while driving, and 15 banned the use of handheld phones for any purpose while behind the wheel. Cell phones also made for breaches of etiquette. In one survey, 82% of Americans said they had been irritated by loud and annoying cell phone users in public places, but only 8% admitted being scolded for making loud and annoying calls in public places. Socializing and shopping on the web. If you got a busy signal on your cell phone, there was always email. Like the cell phone, technology for sending electronic text improved considerably from the first attempt to send a message via the Internet in 1969 by scientists at UCLA and Stanford University. The system crashed as soon as the sender typed the G in login. By 2017, an estimated 269 billion emails were being sent worldwide each day, about two-thirds of which were believed to be spam, the electronic version of junk mail. The average U.S. office worker received 121 emails per day. So ubiquitous was email that 50% of Americans acknowledged reading emails in bed, and 42% while using the toilet. Emails and the web begat blogging, which emerged in the 1990s. Blogs, short for weblogs, were essentially a discussion site usually focused on a particular subject or person and overseen by an individual, organization, or company. Most blogs allowed people to contribute commentary and information. They also served as marketing tools, and they fostered a panoply of social media. Facebook, founded in 2004 and initially designed for college students, this social networking service let friends, relatives, and sometimes perfect strangers exchange messages, share photos, recipes, and favorite books, and join common interest groups. By 2017, Facebook had more than 2.2 billion active monthly users, those on the site at least once a month, worldwide, and an annual net income of nearly $16 billion. LinkedIn. Launched in 2003, this site was designed for business people to find jobs and potential employees and keep track of other people in their industry or profession. It had 146 million active U.S. users in 2017 and more than 260 million globally. In 2016, the software giant Microsoft bought LinkedIn for $26 billion. Twitter. Created in 2006, Twitter was envisioned as a microblogging service that let users send text messages, as long as they kept it to 140 characters or fewer. By 2018, its 335 million active monthly users posted 500 million tweets per day, and the company had doubled the number of characters per tweet. President Trump was an inveterate and, to some, an incorrigible tweeter. Trump averaged 7 tweets per day during his first year in office. His tweets ranged from rants to ruminations and often became front-page news. Doing business on the web. Email and the web in general were both a boon and bane to U.S. business. Though email made staying in touch with customers, suppliers, information sources, and colleagues a snap, studies found that some workers spent up to 28% of their day sending electronic messages, interrupting their focus and reducing productivity. For American retailers, the web presented both peril and opportunity. Sales of goods via websites, called e-commerce, accounted for just 8.9% of total U.S. retail sales in 2017. But that was double its share from a decade earlier, and the percentage was expected to double again by 2022. Companies that were quick to set up websites as auxiliaries to their traditional brick-and-mortar stores were, in many cases, able to compete with companies that consisted of mostly www. addresses and distribution facilities. Those that were slow to embrace e-commerce or tried to sell a multitude of products rather than specialize sputtered or went out of business. Entertaining ourselves by ourselves. Once upon a time, say around 1995, Americans who had a yen to see a movie could visit their neighborhood video store, pluck down a few bucks, and rent a VHS tape for a day or two. Of course, if they brought it back late, they had to pay another buck or two. Fast forward to 2018. For less than $15 a month, Americans could click a button and watch all the movies they wanted without ever leaving the couch, which is the major reason most video stores, including the 9,000-store Blockbuster chain, were out of business by 2013. The shift was emblematic of Americans moving to the Internet for their entertainment. Streaming video companies, such as Netflix and Hulu, offered films and TV shows, sans commercials, on a monthly subscription basis. If you fancied something a bit less polished, there was the no-cost YouTube, a 2005 launched website on which people could post videos. The subjects ranged from an infant biting his brother's finger, 863 million people around the world watched it, to a pudgy South Korean pop singer performing. This one topped 3.2 billion views. There were also online games to play. Americans played tennis, killed zombies, and stole cars, all from their desks or easy chairs. Opponents, often complete strangers, could come from anywhere in the world. Remember, entertainment made up a good part of Americans' time online, and that was plenty of time. A 2016 U.S. Census Bureau study found that the average American adult spent about 6 hours a day online, compared to about 3 hours watching television and 30 minutes reading. In fact, the study reported, the average American spent more time just surfing the web than volunteering, attending social events, or going to church. A study by the National Bureau of Economic Research concluded those extra minutes online weren't just coming out of reading or TV time. Americans were spending less time sleeping, eating, cleaning the house, traveling, and hanging with the family. Some academic studies suggested that all that internet use was making many people unhappy and unsociable. On the other hand, other studies found that nearly 20% of newly married American couples met each other through internet dating sites. But one thing everyone agreed on was that all this internet activity was being watched and manipulated. Using technology to spy, lie, and meddle. For all the information Americans got from the web, tech-savvy companies gathered loads of information in return. Retail businesses routinely monitored individuals' web surfing habits and tailored ads for products and services to pop up when someone opened a web page. How pervasive or invasive web snooping could be was exemplified in 2018 by a cleaning supplies company that teamed with a technology firm that produced thermometers. The thermometers could take a person's temperature and record and update it on a cell phone app. The collected data allowed the cleaning company to target specific geographic areas experiencing flu outbreaks and then ratchet up its advertising in the area for products like disinfectant wipes. Spying on ourselves. But retail advertisers weren't the only ones using technology to ratchet up their stores of information. In the wake of the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks, the federal government had quietly expanded its security and surveillance efforts. In June 2013, Americans began finding out how much. Almost simultaneously, the London-based Guardian newspaper and the Washington Post ran stories that revealed the FBI and the National Security Agency were gathering information about the emails, photos, phone calls, and documents of U.S. citizens. The information, from cell phone and internet companies, had been secured under a secret order issued by the U.S. Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, FISC, which was created by Congress in 1978 to oversee domestic surveillance by federal intelligence agencies in cases where criminal activity was suspected. The information-gathering program was codenamed PRISM. The agency cited anti-terrorism laws that had been passed in 2008 as their authority for the operation. The 200,000-plus documents the newspaper stories were based on came from Edward Snowden, a 30-year-old former CIA employee who had also worked for the NSA as a contractor. Snowden said he leaked the information because he was appalled at the damage the spying programs were inflicting on American civil liberties. But federal officials saw his acts as traitorous, and he was indicted for espionage shortly after the stories ran. His prosecution was problematic because he had fled the country. As 2018 ended, Snowden was living under a grant of temporary asylum in Russia. The revelations outraged civil liberties groups, who filed suit in federal courts. The surveillance also worried U.S. tech industry companies, who feared that foreign governments and businesses wouldn't trust U.S. firms with sensitive data because the U.S. government might be sifting through it. And the spying programs alarmed members of both parties in Congress, angered both at the spying and the fact that they didn't know about it. But while more than 20 bills were introduced to curb the authority of federal agencies to snoop on Americans, nothing of substance passed into law. The biggest impacts were that news stories based on Snowden's documents occasionally surfaced, and large web-based companies such as Google and Apple tightened up, sometimes without success, unauthorized access to private data they collected on their customers and users. Most of the country was ambivalent about the spying and about Snowden. Opinion surveys showed that while about half of Americans thought the revelations served the public interest, more than half thought Snowden deserved to be prosecuted anyway. And about half were not too confident in the government's ability to protect online data, or, as it turned out, to prevent foreign meddling in U.S. elections. The Russian Factor. In early September 2016, Secretary of Defense Ash Carter issued a public warning to the Russian government. "We will not ignore attempts to interfere with our democratic processes," he said. Carter's warning came as evidence piled up that Russian-backed computer manipulators, known as hackers and trolls, were working to undermine America's election system. The cyber attacks ranged from stealing and then publicizing private emails from the Democratic National Committee to creating fake websites and blogs designed to sow discord and division. The Russians' goals, according to a January 2017 joint report by the CIA, FBI, and NSA, were to undermine faith in the U.S. democratic process.